Roughly 3,700 years ago, in the Fertile Crescent of Mesopotamia, the first Western epic was composed. The character Gilgamesh and his friend Enkidu have many adventures battling mighty beasts. But when Enkidu dies, Gilgamesh is thrown into what we would today call an existential crisis. Gilgamesh grapples with themes such as friendship and love, mortality, free will and fate, loss, and the search for meaning. Since that time, literature has been consistently used as a vehicle to explore philosophical themes, whether that be the ancient Greeks through the Iliad and the Odyssey, or the modern existentialists. But why is this? Aren't philosophical treatises sufficient? There's something about literature as an alternative avenue to philosophical thought. Rather than a treatise with syllogisms, points and counterpoints, thought experiments, and the like, great literature allows us to contemplate some of life's greatest mysteries with a little life breathed into it through colorful characters, allegorical tales, intricate metaphors, or captivating dialogues. Through this vehicle, philosophical literature challenges readers to ponder the nature of truth, the meaning of happiness, and the complexities of human relationships. But can literature be considered philosophy? Does it do a disservice to the philosophical enterprise? And ultimately, what is its value to human experience? So join us as we explore the connection between philosophy and literature. Hey everyone, welcome to Open Door Philosophy. I'm Derek Parsons, and along with me is Andrew Graziano.
Howdy.
And Taylor Jones.
Hey everyone.
And welcome to episode 61, where today we're excited to talk about the topic of, well, the connection really, between philosophy and literature. But before we do that, how's it going, guys? We're in the depths of summer.
I'm good. I haven't been doing a whole lot. I've gotten back into watching baseball, and the Astros have been playing almost every day. So, lots of baseball to watch, and really partaking in my grandma hobbies of crocheting. So that's kind of all I do, crochet and watch baseball. So pretty good.
Do you crochet while you watch baseball?
Sometimes, yes. Yes, I do.
Oh, yeah.
My mom's super into crocheting and knitting, so I have massive respect. I think I've said that before.
Maybe. My Nana just gave me a giant bag of yarn, so I have so much. Like a lifetime.
I know what to get you now for Christmas.
That's dangerous.
So perfect. Yeah.
That's dangerous.
Get you a bunch of wacky yarn. You can crochet me a Taylor Swift cardigan.
I could. Have to find one of those patterns. I think a lot of people have made them.
I'm sure. Okay. Andrew, how are you?
I'm good. I've been enjoying summer too. It's been kind of busy, but I've been getting into these Netflix shows. So this big one that I've been watching recently is Suits. It's an awful TV show. It's actually so garbage.
It's terrible.
It's terrible, but it's like addictive. So that's been fun. And then my mom and I have been watching one of my favorite TV shows, Better Call Saul, a fantastic Netflix binge-worthy show if anyone's interested.
Oh, I need to watch that. I was so into Breaking Bad. I've never watched Better Call Saul. I've heard great things about it.
Yeah. If you like Breaking Bad, it's really good. All of my friends are super into both of them, but we were like the guys that I went to Europe with, we were just like quoting Better Call Saul back to back to back. So it's a great show. Really glad, like my mom, she'd seen Breaking Bad and then she was waiting to see Better Call Saul, and I'm so glad she's seeing it because she likes it a lot. Highly recommend.
So many philosophical issues in Breaking Bad.
Oh yeah. Better Call Saul too. Huge.
I'm sure.
What's been up with you?
Well, I'm doing fine. Yeah, I'm doing fine. It's I have 1 week left of summer before I'm back on contract, so I'm going to leisure it up as much as I can.
It's exciting.
Which I've been doing anyway.
Yeah.
So. Yeah, my daily routine has been pretty well routine these last couple of weeks. Once we got back from Colorado, it's just get up, drink some coffee, eat breakfast, read, go for a walk, come back, read a little more, and then who knows what the rest of the day holds. So, yeah, it's been great.
Well, I was going to say that's a great transition to, you know, reading, but it sounds like something else is on the docket, right?
Something else is indeed on the docket. So the day that we're recording today saw the new release of the latest Taylor Swift re-record, which is Taylor Swift Speak Now, Taylor's version, came out today, and Taylor Jones and I are very excited about it. And Andrew is rolling his eyes,
yeah,
but that's okay.
No clue this was coming out, and I think both of you knew this was coming out at least a week ago, so props.
Oh, we knew like a month ago, my friend.
Yeah.
We've been preparing.
Maybe.
We've been doing warm-ups,
wait,
calisthenics, getting ready.
Okay, so for somebody like me who's just completely out of the loop, can you all explain what the heck is going on?
Yeah, so it's really interesting, and I'll try not to go super in-depth. So, especially with like how the music industry works. So, the music industry, you're an artist, you sign with a label, that label produces your album and then distributes your music. And so for doing that, they take a certain cut of your of the profit. And the music industry, I mean, since the 1960s, have been notorious for really kind of screwing over artists from time to time. And, you know, music execs are kind of famous for being kind of slimy like that and everything. So anyway, it's a really interesting like intellectual property right question, but like who owns the music? So I'm thinking of some famous cases where back in the 1980s, Michael Jackson very famously bought the entire Beatles collection and he owned the Beatles music, which means Ringo Starr and Paul McCartney, they can't do anything with it. And, you know, if Michael Jackson wants to sell, that's a good Beatles song, Let It Be to Ford so that they can use it in their commercial, well, then Paul McCartney has no say over that because he doesn't own the music, even though he made the music. And so another famous, and of course, this is a way that musicians can get really wealthy, too. Just a few months ago, Genesis, and if anyone knows Genesis, you probably know, the person you probably know from Genesis is Phil Collins. Oh. They just sold their entire catalog for $300 million. And there's three members of Genesis, so each one of them got $100 million for selling their music. So the question is, when music is produced and you have this complicated web of producers and record companies and distribution and the artists themselves, who owns the music? And so, to Taylor Swift, a couple of years ago, her music was sold to
Scooter Braun.
Yeah, Scooter Braun.
By Scott Bruschetta.
He's kind of a controversial guy in his own right. Right, like I think Drake.
Well, he is, and that's why Taylor. I mean, it's one thing to like have a label own your music, but it's another thing when the person who owns it is someone you really despise and despicable.
Yeah,
and will probably do rotten things with your music.
Oh, with her, not only that, but she had requested to buy her masters, and Scott Bruschetta told her no, and then went behind her back to sell the rights to Scooter Braun. And she
Which
didn't
of course
know
is
that deal was happening.
Millions and millions of dollars. I mean, like, so the way record contracts are written with certain artists is that after a certain amount of time when the music is originally released, the artist can re-record those original recordings. So what Taylor Swift has done the last couple of years is take her older recordings and basically re-record the music. And so the album that came out today, which is Speak Now, which came out 12 years ago, I think?
13.
13 years ago. Mm-hmm. Came out 13 years ago. She's re-recorded it, and it sounds almost identical. And so the album is called Speak Now, parentheses, Taylor's version. And so now she owns that particular music, not the other company. And so whenever that music is played or streamed on Spotify or used in commercials or whatever, whatever it gets used for, she receives the proceeds rather than the previous owner who still owns like the original Speak Now. So anyway, that's the story. And so the philosophical question, there's a number of them, but one of the philosophical questions I think that's good to think about with this particular case, but it applies broadly to art in general, is like, who should own art? That's the philosophical question that kind of comes to mind with this. So what do you guys think? It doesn't even have to be Taylor Swift specific. Like, who should own art?
I think that if the artist wants to own their art, that there should be easier avenues for them to do that. If they put all the time and energy into this whole process of creating a work, like creating a whole album, especially like Taylor Swift building all these things from the ground up so young and then offering to buy it back and not even having that to be a deal on the table, I think is kind of ridiculous, that so many musicians aren't even able to own their art. And that's just kind of the norm, that your masters belong to someone else. And you can create music, but you can't own it.
Yeah. It just sounds like the agents or the lawyers or whatever didn't do a good job. Maybe that's a viable contract strategy in the future that artists need to be aware of. I don't know how I feel about this. I don't have an opinion. Not really. But if I'm looking at it from the music industry side of things, I mean, it's probably... I'm trying to remember where I heard this, so I'm just not pulling it out of thin air. But I'm assuming the music industry is no different from like a company that a hedge fund takes.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's probably a very, very low success rate for an artist that a music company... Mm-hmm. I don't know, maybe like 3% or something. And so when an artist first starts out, I don't know how long Taylor Swift has been going on for, but 12 years ago, that's a very long time. And I don't know how established she was. So they're taking all this risk. You say Taylor did a lot of creative stuff, and she probably did, but the studio is paying for the sound recording equipment, all of the... probably the producers too, I'm guessing, the time in the studio. Not only that, but they're paying for her instead of another musician. I mean, all of that adds up. And so should Taylor...
And distribution.
Yeah, and distribution, mm-hmm. exactly. Negotiating the deals with Spotify, Apple Music, CD Records, getting her mm-hmm. into stadiums, whatever. Should she have like an option to do that? I don't know, maybe. But is there a case for the music industry too? Probably.
Yeah, and it's not too unlike the publishing world, too, for authors.
Yep. Yeah, you know,
that's once, who I was thinking
you
got of.
Publishing houses and editors, and they distribute it and advertise. And so when you walk into Barnes & Noble and you see that cute little display of whoever's new book is. By the way, authors and artists make pennies off of those. Like I read, or I was listening to a podcast about Spotify, and artists, each time they're song is streamed,
mm-hmm. yep.
it's like tenths of a penny.
Yep. Yep.
Yeah.
And you know, for Taylor Swift, she's going to make money off of that because she gets millions mm-hmm. of streams. But for smaller artists, and it's the same for publishing, right? Like smaller authors, someone who's going to write a book on philosophy might not have the same reach as, say, Stephen King. Yeah, there's a lot. There's a lot tied up financially. Mm-hmm. That does bring this sort of ethical dimension to it. It's like, who should be making the money? And it's, of course, everyone should be making money, but it's like, is that money being distributed equitably?
Mm-hmm.
And that's why a lot of larger artists, publishing and music, will
start their own label companies too.
Kind of rally for the smaller artists because mm-hmm. they have the power and the voice to do that.
Let me, Taylor, if you have anything to say about this, let me turn this for one last little spin.
Okay.
So I'm thinking about now, I mean, this is a little different with copyright laws, and I can talk about that in a second. But if you think about these huge symphonies who re-record Beethoven, or who re-record Mozart.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
I mean, Beethoven 9th, probably the most famous piece ever, or Beethoven's 5th, one of those. I mean, that's been recorded by probably every prominent orchestra. Not only has it been recorded by every prominent orchestra, but that orchestra has probably recorded it like 6 or 7 times. You know, the New York Phil's mm-hmm. probably recorded Beethoven's 5th 5 or 6 times, maybe more. Is there a big difference in that, like a symphony re-recording that piece of music, than Taylor Swift doing that?
I would say yes, because they didn't compose the music. They didn't create the piece. But Taylor did write almost all of her music. She wrote everything that she's recorded, and a lot of it she's done on her own. Like with Speak Now, she wrote the entire album alone.
No. I'm just curious. Does she write like... does she produce the labels too? Like, does she do the sound, soundtracks, beats?
Mm-hmm.
She does all of that?
Not exclusively herself, but she is like very involved in the whole process. And I think on Speak Now, Taylor's version, she's credited as an executive producer. I don't know really what that means, but she's so involved in the writing and creation process that I think that's a big difference of just recording a piece of music, like a cover, versus like creating a piece and then re-recording your own work.
I'm going to guess, I'm sure she's very involved, but I'm going to guess that that mm-hmm. label as an executive producer is a nice way of their label trying to sign her. That they slap a executive producer stamp on the cover or in the credits or something.
I mean, it gets really complicated from a legal standpoint and a contract standpoint, which is like really interesting you brought that up about Beethoven. I think the difference there is, of course, Beethoven isn't around to enjoy the proceeds.
No.
Yeah.
And it's interesting to think that someone owns Beethoven's
Fifth Symphony.
Does. I don't
nobody
know if
does.
Someone owns it, actually. Nobody does. But, you know, you might think like his ancestors or some foundation that's been created for him or his museum or some, you know, something like that. Yeah, and when you get to the question, the broad question of who should own art, I think it's a very different situation to say like someone like Taylor Swift who's alive right now and doing the thing versus say Van Gogh or Beethoven or you know statues from ancient Greece in the British Museum and things like that.
I don't know if we should compare Taylor Swift to Van Gogh or Beethoven or
oh no, I'm not meaning to other than she's alive and they're not.
I see.
I think that changes the question a little bit when it comes to when you say who should own art.
Well, here's another thing too, and I know we've been talking about this for a while, but she did sign contracts, right? She agreed. Mm-hmm. She agreed to sell. There is agency there.
Do you mean when the masters were sold originally? Because I don't think she was involved in that. Like, I don't know that she even knew that they were being sold to Scooter Braun.
Does she even have a say in that being sold?
But she had to sign, like, her music to a label in the first place, right?
Yeah, when she signed on to them.
Yeah.
And so when she signs on, she probably saw, I mean, maybe she didn't, but her lawyer saw that that company has the right to the music. And I'm sure she was informed of that. And so she probably willingly signed. I mean, I highly doubt that the company in the first place just took it. There's no way.
Well, again, like the music industry is famous for their contracts being sneaky. It's also very similar to, say, the film industry. Actors will sign contracts with studios. And, you know, when they're signing those contracts, especially if they're young actors and they don't have a lot of leveraging power, in those contracts, you sign whatever you sign just to get your foot in the door. And I think that's what happened with Taylor Swift's early recordings. She obviously doesn't have the influence she has now when she originally signed those. You know, I'm also thinking of, speaking of property rights, you know, these actors who are in these movies, they don't own their acting. They don't own that movie unless they're able to negotiate in their contract that they own or they receive a certain percentage of proceeds from the movie. One of the slickest things any movie maker ever did was George Lucas, who made Star Wars, is when he negotiated the deal that he would receive the proceeds from any toys that were made that using the likenesses of Star Wars. And that was a huge win for him. Otherwise, it would have been like 20th Century Fox or something in the proceeds of all those toys that were sold that I bought when I was
a kid. And are still being sold.
So anyway, they're still being sold. That's right. I mean, we could go on and on about this.
Yeah,
it is fascinating,
though.
What we're talking about is like owning ideas. And owning ideas is really a fascinating sort of, idea. How's that for a segue? That's not a segue, actually. There's definitely some ethical issues involved in it.
For sure.
And just because something's legal, you know, doesn't make it right.
Right, yeah.
Morally right. All right, guys. Well, here we go. We're going to talk about the connections between philosophy and literature today. We're going to talk about a number of different books, and we're going to talk about it conceptually, literature as philosophy, and examples of philosophy and literature. So we got a whole lot of good stuff for you here today. But I do want to do a disclaimer at the beginning here. This will not be a comprehensive overview of this particular topic, because it just simply can't be. It's too huge of a topic. We joked when we were talking about this particular episode. We're like, this could be like a 30-part series. And then we're like, or it could actually be its own podcast, because there's so many works of literature that have to do with philosophy. And so anyway, we're obviously not going to get really super in-depth with any of these works, but hopefully give you some ideas of how philosophy can work in literature and in what ways it does work in literature, and give you some examples of that from books that we've pulled from our experience. So anyway, literature is philosophy, guys. I guess before we get into all the meat and potatoes about meat and potatoes, is that what I want to say? Before we get into all the details, speaking of metaphors, all the details of this particular episode, let's try to answer this question. What is the point of literature? Like, why does it even exist? Why do we have it?
What a fantastic question. I would say that it's a way for people to share their life experiences and connect with other people and kind of delve into issues that maybe they experienced or other people have experienced and play out hypothetical scenarios. But it can also just be for the sake of literature. I don't think that there always has to be a big existential meaning. It can just be written for the sake of writing a story.
Hmm. Okay. Well, you know where I'm going to go with all of us. I think that Aristotle is probably the best person to, or I think his definition or his understanding of literature is the best. Aristotle, I mean, in his Poetics, he discusses what the purpose of art is. And art, the purpose of art is to imitate life. And I don't know if he talks about literature in there, but he talks about kind of the poetic, and I think, or poetry. And I think this can be applied more generally to the novel or to literature too. And he says that the purpose is to provide pleasure and to teach. And I think that's just a perfect example. I mean, what else could it be for? Now, there's different types of literature that we'll talk about. There's the novel. There's the poem, too. I mean, like the epic. There's the tragedy. And those all have different purposes in themselves. But literature as a whole, it's just an art that imitates life.
I mean, it's so easy to start with ancient Greece and all the drama and all the epics and everything. Mm-hmm. It makes me think, you know, when I think about what the point of literature is, with what you said, Andrew, it kind of makes me think the point is just to bear witness, right? To bear witness to the human experience. And sort of in an existential way, say like, mm-hmm. I was here and this is what I experienced. And that sounds autobiographical, which is a type of literature. But what I mean by that is, especially when we're talking about fiction or dramas or something like that, you're pulling from your human experience or from an imagined experience that you can mm-hmm. place yourself into or characters into, of course, and bear witness to just being human and all the messiness that comes with it.
Yeah. The language that you use there is really interesting. You said pulling from, and I think that's right too. I've been thinking about this a lot. And the only thing that I've been thinking about this writing process, and the only thing I can think of is that what we do when we think of, if we imagine the writer, like who writes literature, what are they doing? They're pulling an abstract idea from their head, from their reality, how they see the world, and then they're putting that into language in their mind, right? They're translating that expression or thought into language in their mind, so that they can understand it. And then they're using language in whatever method they are to put that on the page. Mm-hmm. And that's really interesting because, I mean, it's an abstract idea. And what's really cool is the language that they use is a view into how they see the world. So I think there's something special about that written medium. That's the only way that we are connecting with the abstract world, that we're pulling from the abstract to the concrete. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I tell students one of the reasons I really encourage them to reflect and write journals and stuff on what we talk about is that, and I can't remember where I heard this quote, so sorry to the originator, but writing memorializes thought.
Yeah.
Like when you write it down, just like you're saying, Andrew, it makes that thought manifest in the world. And other people can access it. You can access it later and see where you were for a particular point in your life. But yeah, it makes it concrete, like you said.
Yeah.
We're talking awfully high and mighty stuff. How about this? What about literature for entertainment, just for the sake of pleasure?
Yeah.
I think we see that, at least now, with the popularization of just the fun, light mm-hmm. romance novel, especially around of girls my age and kind of a little bit older than me, that so many people have gotten back into reading for the sake of like light, fun pieces rather than something that's deeply philosophical and forces you to reflect, because people don't always want to have to keep thinking, that they want something to pull them out of their reality. And literature for pleasure does that in a very different way than philosophical literature does.
Yeah, like some of the books we're going to talk about today aren't exactly beach reads, you know.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm thinking about what's the guy equivalent of that. I'm thinking like sci-fi or something. Or I was never really that big into it, but I know that a lot of people are into these like weird sci-fi kind of books or fantasy adventure or something. I don't know what mm-hmm. they would be, but like Ender's Game, I guess that's maybe philosophical too, but I get what you mean.
Yeah, and just
they're just kind of fun reads.
Yeah, like dystopian's very popular, and there's like fun lightweight dystopian, and then there's like heavy mm-hmm. instructive, meant as a warning for the future type of dystopian.
Yeah.
And I think even the light YA mm-hmm. dystopian stuff, though, still has a message in there. It's just mm-hmm. you can fly through it, and it's just kind of an entertaining deal.
If you think about like the Hunger Games, and when people have started diving into all the little details, you can see how Suzanne Collins built the world in such a particular way to communicate things that a lot of us didn't catch when you're 12, 13 years old reading a book, that it just kind of goes over your head until you're older and looking back at it and can sit down and see all of these things that have so much impact within the world of the story.
Yeah, you're like, am I Katniss? Am I fighting for the freedom of people? Or am I mm-hmm. a member of the Capitol and I don't even know it, you know?
Yeah.
Well, so we're throwing around philosophical literature and that term around a lot. Is philosophical literature different than philosophical nonfiction work? And I think the answer is probably pretty clearly yes. But so like, in mm-hmm. what way is philosophical literature different than a nonfiction piece of philosophy? And in what ways are that important?
Yeah, I mean, like you said, there's clearly a difference. What difference that is, I think there is something to the easiness and the accessibility mm-hmm. of that. I'm trying to find this quote. The first one that came to mind to me earlier was The Stranger with Albert Camus, and then mm-hmm. comparing that to his myth of Sisyphus.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I think that's a good place mm-hmm. maybe to start with this discussion. I have another book that I definitely want to talk about, but let's, because I think we're all familiar with that, and that's a pretty common one. I'm going to be honest. I have The Stranger right here, but or maybe we should even start with The Myth of Sisyphus, because that's kind of, I think, even broader.
So The Myth of Sisyphus by Camus, you're right, Andrew, it's a nonfiction piece. It's about, at least in the book that I have it in, it's about 120 pages. So it's not a short piece. It is a nonfiction piece that he is grappling with this idea of the absurd. The opening line is a very famous line. He says, "There is but one serious philosophical problem, and that is suicide. Judging whether life is or is not worth living amounts to answering the fundamental question of philosophy." And that's what the entire Myth of Sisyphus is about. The part that most people will be familiar with the Myth of Sisyphus is the last three pages, which is where he concludes with this story about Sisyphus, the Greek character who rolls this rock up a hill, only to have it roll back down again. And that's at the end, and typically that's what students will read in school, because it's short, it's to the point, and it's really beautifully written. Mm-hmm. Boy, it's just some gorgeous lines in that. But gosh, there's another, 115 pages or something that comes before that. And here is Camus, he's trying to answer this question of whether or not life is worth living from a philosophical perspective. And he reaches back and references a number of philosophers and their ideas. He talks about Kierkegaard, and he ultimately comes up with a couple of reasons that he feels that he should be able to philosophically reject suicide. And that's the point of that work. But it's structured, and it goes through all these problems and counter problems in a very systematic way. He agrees with Kierkegaard on some things. He disagrees with Kierkegaard. I mean, it is a great example of a long philosophical essay. So that's The Myth of Sisyphus.
And then The Stranger by Albert Camus. It's been a while since I've read this, so I may not get all of the details right. But generally, there's a man named Rousseau who's kind of going on day to day in his life, and he's not really happy. He's just going through the motions, and he has a girlfriend, but he's not really in love with her. He just everything in his life. He's just going through the motions. He has a couple of friends, and one day they have a beach day and they're just out having fun, and there's a bit of a conflict with somebody else, and he ends up shooting the person and he gets arrested. He doesn't really have a lot of remorse for his actions, and I think the second half of the novel kind of follows him as he's in his prison cell kind of reflecting. It seems as though, at least when I read it, that he kind of dissolves into, contemplates the absurdity of reality, and I think it does mirror the myth of Sisyphus and how it can just be so absurd to go through all of these motions day to day, but almost comes to a different conclusion. I can't remember what he realizes in the end, but I do remember that in the myth of Sisyphus, Camus concludes that one must imagine Sisyphus happy, but I don't think you could consider Meursault happy.
Oh, I agree on that, yeah.
No, he's not happy. He basically accepts his death at the end of the book and spends his last days like just like contemplating. It's an awful book.
I would
it's
agree.
A great book too. It's an excellent book.
Not a super enjoyable read, at least for me. I don't find existentialist literature riveting or as enjoyable as some people may, because I know a lot of people do really enjoy existentialist literature and find it very interesting. I am just not one of them.
Yeah, so the end of The Stranger is quite telling when he has this moment of realization, reflecting on his life. Meursault, the main character, the book's also written in the first person, which might be a topic for another episode, but he ends the book, Camus, with Meursault saying, "As if that blind rage had washed me clean, rid me of hope. For the first time in that night, alive with signs and stars, I opened myself to the gentle indifference of the world, finding it so much like myself, so like a brother, really. I felt that I had been happy and that I was happy again, for everything to be consummated, for me to feel less alone. I had only to wish that there be a large crowd of spectators the day of my execution, and that they greet me with cries of hate." The end.
All right. Well, Andrew, you brought up both these works, The Stranger and The Myth of Sisyphus. So why these two, and what do you want to say about them?
Well, I think it's just a really good example of, I think that both of them explore a similar theme. Like you both mentioned, this kind of theme of absurdism that Camus was really obsessed with. They both have similar themes, but they both accomplish how they reach those themes, how they present them to the audience differently. So I was hoping we could talk a little bit about what's the difference, how it might hit us differently. I mean, Mr. Parsons, like you said, Taylor and I both aren't big fans of The Stranger, but I think we can both agree it's written very well. It's very easy to get through. It's a very easy read. It's translated, of course, but it's a very easy read. The Myth of Sisyphus, despite it being a piece of, maybe not a treatise, but that's the closest thing I can think to it, it's also very beautiful and not that difficult of a read, too. So I was hoping we could talk about why do you think that Camus used these two different forms of literature to express similar themes? What was the goal there?
Well, I think for me, you guys already gave the response to that question, which is when you both were talking about The Stranger, you're having an emotional reaction to it. You're like, oh God, I hate that book. Whereas, you know, you might read Hegel and be like, oh God, I hate Hegel. But the reason you have that emotional response is because I think with literature, as opposed to some nonfiction piece, although you might feel that Camus' Myth of Sisyphus is very beautiful, it doesn't necessarily invoke the same types of emotions that a character in a story might invoke. And so I think for a person reading a novel, not necessarily for philosophy, but they read something like The Stranger, that emotion connects them to those philosophical ideas, and they're able to engage with that idea kind of in a different way, really, than the Myth of Sisyphus. It's like the Myth of Sisyphus is kind of the intellectual argument for absurdism, whereas The Stranger is, I don't want to say entertainment, I feel like that cheapens it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think that the novel gives readers a arena to grapple with feelings.
Yeah.
Instead of grappling with
the idea necessarily.
Philosophical principles.
Yeah. Something that you can imagine yourself in that position of living a mundane life, just going through the motions. I think a lot of people can relate to that.
Another piece of philosophical literature that I think is really interesting in kind of contrast to The Stranger, but is also, I'd say it's kind of it's a fun, more fun piece of literature, is Thomas More's Utopia. This is the first book that I can think of that I'm sure there's others, but this is the first one that comes to mind that is a piece of philosophical satire.
Mm-hmm.
Are either of you familiar with this book?
Yeah. Well, it's been a long time, but yeah.
So I guess I can just go over the basics. The book's called Utopia by Thomas More, St. Thomas More for the Catholics and maybe Anglicans too. I don't know. Probably not the Anglicans, actually. But anyway, the book, basically, it's a fictional account where Thomas More meets this guy in, I think, a bar named Hitlode, who is a guy who goes to this island of Utopia. Hitlode is discussing the social and political climate, and he's basically describing the country of Utopia. It's meant to be a satire. That's something that More... So More wrote an intro, kind of an intro, that is really interesting. And the intro is set up as a letter to his friend. And in this letter, it's kind of meant to be like a letter not meant for publication. And he says that, you know, this actually took place. And, well, I'll talk a little bit more about why I think this is interesting in a second. The reason I think this is an interesting contrast to The Stranger is that this is it's a fictional conversation. It's fun. It's fun language, but it's very forward in talking about the political and social implications of this society, of this perfect, so-called perfect society. Whereas in The Stranger, I think that there's certainly no reference to like the word existentialism or absurdism, right? Mm-hmm. And so I'm just curious to get your thoughts on that, if you have any.
Yeah. Well, I don't know, I have necessarily a judgment on that, but there are certainly philosophical works of literature that very directly deals with ideas such as what you're talking about with Utopia. Whereas with The Stranger, you do kind of have to understand a bit more outside of the book exactly what existentialism is. I think that's just a stylistic difference. And I don't think it's specific to any particular age. I mean, we could go all the way back to Plato, and a lot of people will consider his dialogues as literature.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously those very directly deal with specific ideas. But that tradition has continued, you know, today. So you do have some, I think, that do exactly what The Stranger does. You got to do a little outside work, and that brings a little bit more to the work itself. Versus one of these books like the Utopia, which is fiction, but the characters are dealing directly with some philosophical idea.
Yeah, I think so. And I think there's also something too kind of about audience.
Mm-hmm.
Who's the audience going to be reading and aiming the literature towards the audience? In the introduction that Moore writes to his friend, he talks, I think, he gives a really good little discussion of why he wrote this book as more a fiction. And I think basically the point that he makes is that with satire, a book like satire and fiction, it's going to appeal to a lot more people than like a treatise would. People are going to be a lot more interested in it. This is a really funny line that Moore writes, readers of his book. These people lounge around the taverns and over their cups, and they pass judgment on the intelligence of writers. With complete assurance, they condemn every writer, every author by his writings, just as the whim takes them, plucking each one, as it were, by the beard. But they themselves remain safe, out of range, so to speak. No use trying to lay hold of them. These good men are shaved so close, there's not so much as a hair on their heads to catch them by. And I think this is really interesting. And the reason I bring it up is because what do we do when we find like a piece of literature we like? we share it mm-hmm. with friends. Mm-hmm. Mr. Parsons, I remember you saying, like, one of your favorite things to do is gift someone a book
yeah.
that you really
yeah.
like,
yeah.
right? And I think that with literature, there's something about it that you get more invested in it.
Mm-hmm.
And so when an author presents a piece of philosophical literature, there's kind of an investment. You feel one way or the other. It encourages you to debate those ideas in the book. There's a different kind of experience that the reader has with it, mm-hmm. but there's also a kind of different engagement that the reader has with it.
Yeah.
You're encouraged to debate it with friends. You're not dismissing it from the whims. Like if I read a piece of Marx, I'm just going to be like, oh yeah, I hate Capital or whatever. It's an easy thing to dismiss.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. But something like The Stranger, we can talk about why we don't like it. Just can't say we don't like it. I mean, we can, but we're invested in it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think there's kind of a piece of more engagement there. What do y'all think about that?
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. And part of it, I would say, is because when you're reading a novel, you go on the journey with the characters. And they only mm-hmm. know what they know at that time. And they're also learning about their world and their experience as they go along. But when you read a treatise, mm-hmm. you know that the thinker has already thought through all of these ideas, and they're just laying them out for you. You're not really going along their journey. You're just listening to an overview maybe of what it was, how they got from point A to point B, and all the steps it took them to get there. So when you follow a character and you get to go along with them or put yourself in their shoes, you get attached to the characters and start to envision how that would play out for you. And you can also think about how different it would be if you were in that position, and would you make the same choices, and do you agree with the choices that they made? And yeah, I think you do get more invested in that than you would if someone's just recounting their journey to you.
Great.
No, I mean, audience is important. You know, I know mm-hmm. I know Sir Thomas More wrote that also as a political piece, and knew that particular piece would make its way around because of the nature of it, that satire. You know, Jonathan Swift was another great satirist. Of course, Gulliver's Travels is nothing but a satire of the British government.
Yeah.
And Alice in Wonderland, for that matter. A lot of people say that mm-hmm. Alice in Wonderland is just really a criticism of a lot of the politics going on in England at the time. But you package it that way and it becomes interesting to people when they want to share it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The best one I can think of is so short, everyone should read it. A Modest Proposal by Jonathan Swift. Fantastic satire. You start reading it, it's all about the poor, what to do with the poor people in England and Ireland and all that sort of stuff. And it's written in a very rationalistic way. And he eventually is like, so what we need to do is take all the babies and eat them. You know, we take all these the poor, how are we going to feed the poor? Well, they keep having these babies, so let's take a certain percentage of their babies. And you know, and he gives all kinds of like recipes of how to do it, and it's complete satire, but it's so salacious, right? You're like, he's talking about eating babies, and all of a sudden everyone's talking about it. And so what he's done is he's made some pretty big statements about how the United Kingdom, if it was the United Kingdom at that point, is treating mm-hmm. the poor. But he's doing it through this way of, well, obviously the best solution would be is to, eat the children, because, hey, I'd get them off the government's payroll.
Oh my gosh. Wow.
It's great. Everyone should read it. It's short.
You know, the one that I was thinking of, I know that you really don't like, but I think it's a really good example, is Atlas Shrugged.
Oh God.
By Ayn Rand.
Burn it.
Yeah. It's a huge book, and I mean, it deals with really, really complicated topics in libertarianism, I guess, right? And I think, like, who in their right, I mean, like, let's think of, like, John Rawls or Nozick. Who in their right mind would pick up those books for fun and read them?
Right.
Even if Capital, but, like, if you're a Marxist, how many Marxists are going to read that book? How many libertarians are going to read Nozick? How many, like, more left-wing progressive people are going to read Rawls? Like, nobody in their right mind would do that. But, like, Atlas Shrugged, it's a huge book, but it's going to give you an opportunity to explore some of these ideas that she's advocating for, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that's, like, a thing to it, too.
Yep. Lots of people like Atlas Shrugged.
I've never read it. Maybe that'll be my next book.
I've also never read it. I'll need to put together a list of all the books that we've recommended, and I can post that on Instagram.
Oh, don't read Atlas Shrugged. Jesus Christ. Yeah, it's not. I have read Atlas Shrugged, by the way, so I feel like I can speak with authority. Yeah. What this quote, oh God, just cracks me up. So Corey Robin, I don't know who Corey Robin is, but says this: St. Petersburg in revolt gave us Vladimir Nabokov, Isaiah Berlin, and Ayn Rand. The first was a novelist, the second was a philosopher, the third was neither, but thought she was both.
Isaiah Berlin was a great, great philosopher.
I just vehemently disagree with Ms. Rand's view of ethics. But anyway.
So I think I've raised some examples of my experience with philosophical literature were the first ones that I remember, the big ones. But what about y'all? Do you have any that y'all really think of, or your personal experience with philosophical literature?
So for me, I had to really think about this. I mean, you know, you can like read about ethics and the Berenstain Bears or something, or rainbow fish, or but aww, if we're talking about, you know, rainbow high fish literature or something, I have two, and they came in, I put them together because they came in the same year, but I'll only talk about one. And I can't remember now, it's so long ago, because I'm so old. That it was either 8th or 9th grade, I can't remember which, but I had a very passionate teacher. His name was Mr. Storm, which is an awesome name. And he had, like, long blonde hair. And like any good teacher, Mr. Storm from time to time would just kind of go off and talk about some of his favorite things that have nothing to do with the curriculum. So why is he telling an 8th or a 9th grader about these two works I'm getting ready to bring up? So the first one is Les Miserables by Victor Hugo. And I was captivated by it just because of the morality. Mm. Like, I know I've said it on some other episode, you know, Jean Valjean's like my secular Jesus. He's just so moral. Yeah. He grapples with these moral issues. So that was the first big one for me. But in the same year, I also was introduced to Dante's Inferno. And, you know, when you talk about literature and why great literature sticks with us, it's because it has some universal nature to it that is applicable in all walks of life. And so, although it's super cool, some about hell and demons and Greek mm-hmm. mythological characters and all that sort of stuff, but the very first line of the Inferno says, "Midway in our life's journey, I went astray from the straight road and woke up to find myself alone in a dark wood." Mm-hmm. And like, what person hasn't suddenly woken up one day and said, "Oh man, I've lost my way," right? And especially this other line, "Midway on our life's journey." Well, I had a hard time relating mm-hmm. that as a 14-year-old. But as a 50-year-old, I get it. I am midway in my life's journey. And yeah, it's so engaging, that first canto. You get leopards, and they all represent different things. And mm-hmm. here comes Virgil, and he's going to be Dante's BFF yeah. through mm-hmm. this. And anyway.
Beatrice.
Then Beatrice, of course. Of course, Beatrice. Yeah, who doesn't, you know, like a love story. So anyway, those were, mm-hmm. and I guess in the way that it is philosophical, of course, when you talk about hell and then by extension, the other two books, Purgatory and Paradise, you know, why does mm-hmm. Dante place these certain sins in the order that he does? And you start grappling with those yeah. things, and like Circle Two is about lovers, but they were mm-hmm. Like lovers that had affairs yeah. and, you know, it's just all very intriguing. So those two were my first philosophical novels or pieces of literature. How about you, Taylor?
Mm-hmm. I think the one that comes to mind is something that my very passionate English teacher, Mr. Finley, had us read senior year, Silence by Shusaku Endo. It's a novel.
It's a great book. Oh,
so beautiful. I mean, that's definitely top three books for me of all time. I think it's perfect. Could not be better. But it's a novel that follows a Portuguese Catholic missionary as he goes to Japan in search of this other missionary that had gone over there previously. And he's trying to find him while Japan is in their isolationist period, and they're not allowing any Christian missionaries specifically, and they're persecuting Christians. but he goes to Japan anyways and has a journey that very closely mirrors that of Jesus's final days and how he's betrayed by Judas. The main character is also betrayed. And the prose in the novel is so beautiful that, I don't know, I think it's just so powerful, and it really stuck with me because not only was it very rich in philosophical content, but it was also such a great read and very enjoyable, which I don't think you find often in my experience, that a philosophical novel is also very easy to read.
Yeah, Silence is a favorite of mine. It's one of the most thought-provoking books I've read in the last 5 years.
Yeah.
It's just a it'll take you through it.
Yeah.
I know Andrew's had that same response too.
Yeah, I just finished it for the second time.
Oh, did you?
Ooh.
Yeah. Yeah, it's, I just literally probably 2 weeks ago, and it's a tough book. It's very good.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk about a couple of other genres, I suppose you could call them, of philosophical literature, and we'll just go over them fairly briefly. And there's other genres than this, of course. These are just kind of some of the better known ones. So one that's very obvious to talk about is Greek literature. It's kind of where it all started. I already mentioned Plato and his dialogues as being like literature, but you have so many great playwrights from ancient times. Euripides, Aristophanes, Medea is certainly a very well-known one. But boy, one that so many people go back to all the time is the great epic by Homer, the Iliad, and by extension, the Odyssey.
Mm-hmm.
And this opening line of the Iliad. I mean, all the characters in it, Paris, Hector, Patroclus, Agamemnon, Helen, Priam, Odysseus, they all have their own part to play in this story that deals with morality, life, death, how we treat others. So let me just read this opening line because it just sets the entire book. The first word just says, rage. Rage. What person can't relate to rage, right? Rage, goddess, sing the rage of Peleus' son Achilles, murderous, doomed, that cost the Achaeans countless losses, hurling down to the house of death so many sturdy souls, great fighters' souls, but made their bodies carrion, feast for the dogs and birds, and the will of Zeus was moving towards its end. Begin, muse, when the first two broke and clash, Agamemnon, lord of men, and the brilliant Achilles. And you might say the entire book is about Achilles. Oh my gosh, what a fantastic book. And so, of course, people have referenced it for centuries. And it's because that's what great literature does, is you connect with these characters. Like if you've ever been a parent that's lost a kid, oh my gosh, Priam, who comes to Agamemnon in the night. No, it's Achilles. He comes to Achilles in the middle of the night to ask for his son's body back. I mean, oof, there's just so many heavy things in there. And, you know, Hector protecting his brother and gosh, all these things. Agamemnon and his ego. Certainly Achilles and his ego. The faithful Patroclus. But anyway, I could go on. But yes, the Iliad is a fantastic one to recommend.
That's a great one.
Well, the next one we got is Shakespeare / Renaissance. We won't get into when the Renaissance happened in England, if it in fact happened in England. But nonetheless, Shakespeare is an easy one to go to, and probably one of the easiest ones to go to is, of course, Hamlet, which is probably his most popular. I don't know if that's true, but it's certainly up there. It deals with all kinds of things about life and death and insanity and power, the corruption of power. But of course, one of the most famous parts is Hamlet's soliloquy about whether or not, because he's in this horrible situation, whether or not it's justified to take his own life. And so I'll do my best to read a portion of the soliloquy. It starts out with the famous lines, "To be or not to be, that is the question. Whether 'tis nobler in the mind to suffer the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, or to take arms against a sea of troubles and by opposing end them. To die, to sleep no more, and by sleep, to say we end the heartache and the thousands of natural shocks that flesh is heir to. 'Tis a consummation devoutly to be wished. To die, to sleep. To sleep, perchance to dream. Aye, there's the rub. For in that sleep of death, what dreams may come when we have shuffled off this mortal coil must give us pause. There's the respect that makes calamity of so long life. Wow. I mean, take the Shakespearean language out of it, and this person is talking about whether it's better to live or die. And if you die, there's nothing else to worry about, because it's done.
Yep, he's great.
Can you guys think of other examples?
The Decameron by Boccaccio. And I think that's an interesting set of stories, because you have a group of people that have fled a plague, and they have nothing to right. do. So they say that every day we're going to tell stories that fit a theme. And so they just sit around telling stories and making things up about tales of different people that have some sort of moral weight. And a lot of times the people have to come up with something clever to get them out of a predicament. Like the woman that has an affair outside of her marriage and says that it's her husband's fault because he was not fulfilling her needs. And then she gets off of the punishment and they're like, okay, that's fine.
I mean, it's very philosophical. You're like trying to justify this action based on someone else's. Yeah. Act. Yeah. Yeah. No, it's great. A lot of people talked about the Decameron, of course, when we went through COVID, because that's what the Decameron was. It was the plague in Italy at that time, and that's when it was written, because we're all just sitting around holed up on our houses.
Yeah.
Yeah. Very, very interesting. Yeah, it's a great example of Renaissance literature.
Shakespeare's Sonnet 73 is a classic. I mean, very famous discussion of death and using the seasons to exemplify that, and I think poetry's like, we could talk about philosophy of poetry too, but Shakespeare is so good. The ending of the sonnet, as the deathbed whereon it must expire, consumed with that which it was nourished by, this thou perceiveth, which makes thy love more strong, to love that will which thou must leave or long. Ugh, so good.
Yeah, so everyone go out and pick up some Shakespeare. It's good stuff. I don't want to do the whole cultural literacy thing, but everyone should read a little Shakespeare and be familiar. But another one, now I don't know if I'd say this, it's quite daunting, Russian literature. Oh boy. But there's some really big ones, and I guess the biggest names are probably Leo Tolstoy and Dostoevsky. There's some other great, of course, Russian authors, but those are the two big ones, and usually associated with existentialism. And so the famous one that probably most people have heard of is Crime and Punishment by Dostoevsky, which deals with this murder and what the guy's going to do about it. But another big one, it was his last book, Dostoevsky's The Brothers Karamazov. That was my COVID read. It makes Crime and Punishment look like a novella.
Yeah.
It's huge. but tells this great story within the story of one of the characters, Ivan. He imagines this story that's set during the Spanish Inquisition. The book's not set during the Spanish Inquisition. This is just some story he's talking about, where he imagines Jesus Christ comes back during the Spanish Inquisition. And this guy, this character named the Grand Inquisitor, has Jesus arrested and interrogated because he accuses Jesus for burdening humanity with freedom and individual responsibility. It's that old thought experiment, like, what if Jesus came back today? Mm-hmm. And the Grand Inquisitor, he says that humanity, it's like a look at human nature. What do humans want? Humanity desires security, comfort, and happiness more than freedom. Because freedom is really just terrifying. And that the church has taken it upon themselves to provide this by controlling people's beliefs and actions through very rigid and dogmatic structure, so they don't have to concern themselves with freedom. And so, like, he doesn't even want Jesus to get out of jail, because he's going to, like, mess with people. And the Grand Inquisitor thinks that humans just aren't equipped to handle freedom, and that Jesus is wrong on this point. And so there's another great example. So many philosophical things to talk about in that particular example. It's another great example of how literature can be philosophical. Okay, so another great and very well-known English author, Tolkien, J.R.R. Tolkien, wrote the Lord of the Rings trilogy. You know, it all doesn't have to be Russian novels, people. Lord of the Rings, for me anyway, is as entertaining as it gets. It's an amazing series of books. But of course, just like with some of these other heavier books that we've been talking about, it talks about a lot of the same things. Good versus evil, the way that power corrupts, if you think of Sauron, and how he became corrupted. Friendship and loyalty, that's all over the place with multiple characters. Free will and destiny, it's all in there. And J.R.R. Tolkien, I mean, it's a masterwork. Don't think you're like picking up some flimsy fantasy book. Lord of the Rings was written to be an epic, and it is. Its language is almost biblical. Like, it is a marvelous, marvelous read.
That book rocked me to my core.
Did it?
Yeah, it's tough. I just think it's a great book. I don't want to really talk about it from like the Catholic point of view, but it rocked me to the core from a religious point of view with sin and a lot of philosophical concepts around that.
Yeah, we'll probably do an episode on Lord of the Rings.
We should do that, yeah.
Well, Taylor, how about the modern resurgence of philosophical novels?
Yeah, while we were planning for this episode, I had posed the question of if philosophical novels still really exist today, because people don't read as much as they used to, I think, just generally, because there's so many other things that we can do to fill our time. And a lot of times we just revert to like TV or social media or things like that. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I do that too a lot of the times. But I was thinking about how during COVID, I saw that a lot of at least girls that were my age started to get back into reading. Mm-hmm. Because we didn't have the constriction of school and like required reading. So people started to fall back in love with reading. And I've noticed that there is the big resurgence of romance novels, but people also are reading novels that may not be a philosophical novel, but they have a lot of philosophical themes. Mm-hmm. And the first person that came to mind was Sally Rooney, who y'all may have heard of. She writes a lot of their romance novels, but not in the traditional sense, because they follow people that are very realistic and have like a lot of their own problems. It makes me think of Normal People, where it's two people that are trying to figure out what does it mean to love somebody else and how do you make that work in real life outside of like a perfect world. Mm-hmm. They may not be philosophical novels, but they definitely have some strong philosophical themes of like identity and love and coming into your own and things like that. But then there's also, I think, more strongly philosophical novels like On Earth We're Briefly Gorgeous by Ocean Vuong and The Little Life by Donna Tartt.
Yeah.
Yeah, they both have a lot of acclaim. I haven't read either of them, but they're very popular for their depth and how they chronicle life.
I think this is kind of unrelated. The Ocean Vuong book is a really good book. But I think Donna Tartt, this is kind of unrelated, but I think that she wrote
The Goldfinch?
She wrote this great book, though, too. Sorry. It's not The Goldfinch. I've heard that one's good. It's called The Secret History. It's really good because it's about these classic students in college. Mm-hmm. Really good. A lot of Greek and Latin. Mostly Greek, though. But it's this the story, I think, is based on, because she studied classics, too. But I think the story is based on the plot line of a Greek tragedy. So it's really good. It's really good. Highly recommend. I'm not usually into these kind of books, but that one was very good. Highly recommend.
Well, that's awesome.
I have heard of that.
Yeah, that's awesome. Yeah, it's really great to see published book selling, all that, to be doing as well as it's doing. You know, with YA novels, those can be poo-pooed pretty quickly, and some of them rightly so.
Understandable,
but
yeah.
If it gets people reading, you know, one minute you're reading some book about vampires or whatever, and then the next minute you fall into, you know, Donna Tartt or Ocean Vuong by extension. And that's fantastic. And I'm happy to see, at least in the United States, bookstores still doing relatively well.
Some of these books, too, I'm not sure. Lord of the Rings wasn't intentionally philosophical. I don't think some of these other books are intentionally either. And I do think that there is a divide between novels that are intentionally philosophical and novels that we read philosophy into them just by part of studying philosophy and listening to philosophy podcasts. And there's a difference there. What kind of difference? It's interesting in its own right, because I think when we interpret a novel as philosophical, I mean, that says something about us, too, as students of philosophy. Mm-hmm. I mean, like we were talking about The Hunger Games earlier. I don't think, I mean, maybe Susan or Suzanne Collins, or maybe she was intentionally writing philosophy into these books. But the fact that we recognize philosophy in them, like coming back to them when we read them when we were 12, that wasn't our original, mm-hmm. or when Taylor and I, guess, read them when we were 12. I mean, that says something about us, too, and the experience of literature, too, as a way for us to, even if it was unintentionally done, it's really interesting that we are exploring philosophy in them ourselves. And I think that says something about literature, too, that it doesn't have to be intentional.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's kind of like a not lazy man's philosophy. You got to bring yourself to some of that to mm-hmm. see philosophy in works versus like a philosophical treatise. I mean, it's like, it's just straightforward.
Exactly.
It's like, here's my point. Here's what I'm going to talk about here. Yeah. Yeah. You got to bring yourself to some of those novels philosophically to discover those things. But I think good literature does that.
Yeah, right? I agree. Mm-hmm. I totally agree. Yeah.
All right, everyone. Thanks for listening today and joining us on this episode about philosophy and literature. We would love to hear about your favorite philosophy in literature book. So that takes us to Taylor.
Please let us know what those are on our socials. On Instagram, you can find us at Open Door Philosophy. And please go check out our YouTube channel too, because Andrew is hard at work and there may be some new things coming soon. Yep. Just a little teaser. But yeah, we would love to hear from you what your favorite philosophical novels are and what you thought of this episode.
I guess that's going to be it for today. Thank you to Kevin MacLeod for the use of his music in the intro and the outro. Thank you very much for listening with us today. And remember, when your life is in need of some philosophy, the door is always open. Thanks.
See you.
Bye.